brother a minute ago was talking about what a child would say. It reminded me of something that I heard just this morning. Yesterday I had a funeral service, and a mother of about a 3 or 3.5 year old little girl attended that. And when she came back, her little girl asked her, "Where have you been?" And she explained to her, "Well, I've been to a funeral." And the little girl says, "Well, what is a funeral?" And so her mother explained, "Well, it's whenever a person dies, people gather there and they remember that person's life, and this was a Christian, and the preacher talked about how this person is going to go to heaven now." And the little girl heard the explanation of all this and looked at her mother and said, "Did you have popcorn?" Now that would be a pretty good funeral, wouldn't it? And her assessment of funerals was such that probably it's a little bit better than ours, in fact. So I may just have popcorn at my funeral. It's kind of difficult to choose a topic when the suggestion is made, let's just suppose that it's your last lecture. What would you say? And I got to tell you, I went through probably 20 different sermons trying to think about this, because I really don't have one particular sermon that I consider to be my hallmark sermon. But my background is counseling, and I work with people individually. And for that reason, and since I had a couple of counseling sessions today, I really decided that I would talk to you about something in my area of expertise, and I say that very reluctantly, because I'm not real sure I'm an expert in anything. But I do know quite a bit about counseling. I've been a professional counselor for about 15 years, have conducted hundreds of counseling sessions, and whether I help these folks or not, I have had an opportunity to delve into the problems of today that maybe a lot of people have not had the opportunity to. And there is something that is frightening me today for our country. I'm a very patriotic person. I mean, I still have tears run down my cheeks whenever the national anthem is played. That's just the way I am. I'm a World War II history buff, and it's just sobering to me to think about what all has been done for America and the sacrifices that have been made. But I'm fearful for America right now. And it's not because of the price of the gasoline. It's not because of any presidential candidate. It's not because of our economy. It's because of the deterioration of the home. And I guess as I thought about this, I decided, you know, if I had one more lecture to give, and since this is kind of an area that I'm quite familiar with, I think I would talk about the importance of the home. I don't believe that we could do any more good for America right now than to improve the home. I've been in the ministry for over 30 years now, 33 years. And there's a change that I have recognized that has taken place over these 33 years that is stark as I look back. And that is that 33 years ago, whenever you had a couple people living together out of wedlock, they didn't talk about it. It was kind of a situation that they didn't want to talk about because there was a sense of shame there. But nowadays, that's not the case. We do a lot of benevolence work at the church, and I try to always ask folks about their home situation, and if I like a lady came in this week and she needed some help on a utility bill on the form that we had her fill out. She said there were four in the household. She talked about she had just gotten her two children back. Well, I can do the math. That's three. And so I asked her, who's the other person? And she said, it's my boyfriend. And it said so matter-of-factly today that people obviously think there's nothing wrong with that. And that's the way the home is supposed to be, a lot of people were thinking today. And so I told her that I couldn't help her with your utility bill because we just could not approve that situation. But I said, I'll tell you what I will do. We'll pay for your marriage license. And I'll do counseling for you to get married, and we'll help you and do all of this. And I have made that offer to probably a dozen, maybe two dozen people, and I have yet to have anyone take me up on it. But that's the culture that we're living in today, and this is what is frightening me about America. This is our greatest threat. Our home is deteriorating. And whenever you have one home deteriorate, it affects the world for generations to come. A number of years ago, study was done and the lives of a couple of people were tracked. One of them was Max Junks, who lived in New York. Max didn't believe in Christ. He didn't believe in Christian training. He refused to take his children to church even when they wanted to go. Max had 1,026 descendants. 300 of these were sent to prison for an average of 13 years. 190 of his descendants were prostitutes. 680 were alcoholics, admitted alcoholics. Max's family cost the state of New York about $500,000 by the time they ended, they finished studying his life, tracking what all had happened. $500,000, and had contributed nothing. At the same time that Max lived in New York, there was another person by the name of Jonathan Edwards that lived in New York. He loved the Lord. He saw that his children were in church every Sunday, and he served the Lord to the best of his ability. Jonathan had 929 descendants. Of these, 430 were ministers. 86 became university presidents. 75 authored good books. 5 were elected to the U.S. Congress. 2 to the Senate. 1 became vice president of this country. And his family never cost the state of New York 1 cent, but contributed immeasurably to the well-being of generations. Now that little study just accentuates what I'm telling you, what you already know. The home is important. And of all the crises that we have in America today, the deterioration of the home, and particularly this thing that two people can just live together and that's perfectly all right with society and God, and they can have children in those kinds of situations, is unacceptable and extremely dangerous. A number of years ago, I thought about this, and I thought about, where do I find an example of a really great home, a perfect home? If I was to talk about an example of the perfect church, I would go to Acts chapter 2. Because it's right when the church came from God's creative hands that it was at its very best. It was everything that God wanted the church to be. it wasn't until man became involved that the church began to have problems. And so as I thought about that, I thought, you know, I believe if I go back to Genesis chapter 2, I'll find the place where the home is going to be exactly what God had intended for it to be, because that's when it's the closest to God creating it or instituting it. And so look with me at Genesis chapter 2 for just a moment. And let me start off by saying that I present this lesson with extraordinary humility. My wife is with me tonight, and she will testify that I'm not a perfect husband, nor am I a perfect father. As a matter of fact, I'd prefer you not even talk to her about that. Brother Ira North used to tell young preachers that if you're going to preach on being a parent, do it before you have a child. Because once you have a child, you'll be like the rest of us, on your knees asking for God's help. And that's exactly right. So you're not looking at a perfect example here. But let's look at the home as it came from God's creative hand. Genesis chapter 2, verse 8 and 9. The Lord planted a garden toward the east in Eden. And there he placed the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. Let me tell you, the Garden of Eden was a beautiful place. My wife has some flower beds at home, and they are just absolutely gorgeous. She has a knack for that. You could take those flower beds and multiply them thousands and thousands of times over, and maybe that would come that close to being Garden of Eden, but not quite. It was an incredibly beautiful place because God had so determined that the home would be a place of beauty. Even today, when we talk about something as being a beautiful place, we say, well, it's just like Eden. In Luke chapter 23, verse 43, when Jesus spoke to the thief on the cross, he says, "Today you shall be with me in paradise." I'm told that the Greek word there for paradise is the same Greek word that is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament for Garden of Eden. It was a place of extraordinary beauty. And that's what we need to make our homes today. We need to make our homes places of extraordinary beauty. And I'm not just talking about physical things. As a matter of fact, physical would amount to maybe 5% at the most. That seems to be what we are so preoccupied with when it comes to homes these days. I went on the internet and just did a word search for a beautiful home, and this is what I came up with. A beautiful home is 2,370 square feet, great floor plan, formal living room and dining room, separate family room with a fireplace, open kitchen with tons of cabinets, breakfast bar and nook area, large master bedroom with full bath, and so on. You see, that's the world's definition of a beautiful home. Someone one time wrote, it isn't the chairs and the books and the things or the pictures on the wall, and it isn't the bird, though gaily he sings. It's the laughter that rings in the halls. It's the smile on the face of the mother at night, and the joy in the little one's eyes, and our love for each other with all its delight that makes up the home we prize. Good memories make up the home, the beautiful home. The laughter, the joy, the companionship, And we need to be diligent to create in the minds of parents and children events which lead them to believe that home is the best place to be. I've met folks before who have had such bitter experiences around home that they've said, I've left home and I'm never coming back. That's sad. We've always had a good home. I grew up in a home that was just beautiful, little old wood frame farmhouse that had a very important piece of furniture in it. Single most important piece of furniture in a beautiful home is a dinner table. And we would sit around that table and we would laugh and we'd tell jokes, we'd talk to each other about what was going on in our lives through the day. But it always ended in laughter. Sometimes we were scolded, sometimes we were corrected, sometimes I was told to eat my English peas, which I still don't like. I can remember one time my mother had spent a good bit of time a particular day making chicken and dumplings. And that was back in the day when if you had chickens, you had to go out and clean it yourself. And she had gone out and cleaned this chicken and made this chicken and dumplings. I didn't like chicken and dumplings. She got Daddy's belt and says, "You will like chicken and dumplings," and I've loved them ever since. But see, those are good memories. And these days when I think of heaven, I still think of that little farmhouse I grew up in. And I still think of the wonderful aroma of fresh brewed coffee on holidays. And during Christmas time, of all the sweets that Mama would leave out on the back porch where it was cool. And the turkey in the oven. Those are the things that embellish homes. And we as parents and grandparents, and I see a number in here that probably are grandparents. You need to make your home beautiful to that next generation. I really envy you. I want to be a grandparent myself. Grandparents have an enormous amount of influence on that little generation. God bless you. Make your home beautiful to them. And so we need to have beautiful homes these days. But number two, look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 9, the second part of it. It says, "The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Then in verse 16 and 17 it's written, "And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it you will surely die." Now, a lot of times folks have asked me, why in the world was there a tree, a forbidden tree, placed in the garden? And my answer to that is that without that tree, there would have been no law. And without law, there would have been no discipline. There would have been no self-denial. There would have been no respect for authority. That tree represented the law of God. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 8 and 9, it's written, "But we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully, realizing the fact that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers." The forbidden tree was put in the garden so that there would be a law, and without a law, we wouldn't know who the criminals are. Without a law, without a concept of right and wrong, we wouldn't know about God, because God is the great I Am, the final absolute authority for all that is right or wrong. And so there had to be a forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden in the very first home, because that represented law. And in God's first home, there were rules. And the rules were really pretty simple. He said, you can eat of any tree of the garden, but there's one tree you shall not eat from. I attended an education convention one time, and a speaker said something I haven't forgotten. He said, today's child is self-absorbed. When the going gets tough, they quit like that. Well, I don't know about that. I think that we have a lot of children without self-discipline. We have a lot of children without respect for authority, because laws were not established in the home. There was no forbidden tree in the home. In Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6, it's written, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he's old, he will not depart from it. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, it's written, and fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. In our home, there was a forbidden tree that represented all the things that my kids could not do, and those things that they knew that were wrong. My kids, for instance, knew that they always had to be in church. For some reason or another, we got this idea these days that we need to let our kids have freedom. And freedom means that they can choose to dress the way they want to, run with the friends that they want to, and just go to church if they want to. Well, take my word for it. If we leave it up to them, they won't. I'll never forget, we had a gospel meeting one time, and one of my kids was watching a baseball playoff between the local high school and another school. And they were going to just stay up there. I had three boys that I raised, and they were going to stay up there till the last minute. Well, the time came, about 5 minutes before the gospel meeting was to start, and they were not there. And I drove over to the ballpark, and I just pulled up in my car, rolled down the window, and just looked at them. And after a couple minutes, one of them turned around. I guess he felt the eyes of dead peering into his very soul, because he looked back, and I've never seen three boys kick up more dust getting to their car like they did. Because the rule in our home was that you always went to church. Our society today, it seems like, has burdened parents with more rules than children. We can't spank. Number three, the home in the Garden of Eden was a place where work was learned and taught to be a virtue. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, the Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden, listen to this, to cultivate it and keep it. Work is not a dirty word. Work should be first of all taught in the home. Let's not depend upon the school district to teach our children how to work. If we wait until they go to school, then most likely they're not going to learn it there. We need to give our children responsibility. Parents need to work. And if dad has to spend long hours at work, so be it. He's teaching a very valuable lesson to his children. And whenever God instituted the Sabbath day of rest, read that sometimes in Genesis chapter, or in Exodus chapter 20. God says, you take one day of rest, but what did he say before that? you work 6 days. And so, right along with the Sabbath rest, there was also the command that they were to work. And the home needs to be a place where we learn how to work. I was taught how to work at home. We need to be taught industry. We need to be taught that work is a virtue. We also need to be taught that church work is important. In Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 12, it says of Shalom that he helped work to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem. It says, he and his daughters. Isn't that wonderful? I've always enjoyed that passage. I could just visualize this man working. Working for God and saying, honey, bring that brick over here. The home needs to be a place. Let me just share with you very quickly the remaining points. The home needs to be a place of mutual support. In Genesis chapter 2, we see how God took the rib from man's side and he made woman. And that's the way it ought to be. That two people, husband and wife, work together as a team. They don't work against each other. Especially when it comes to parenting. Because I've seen this happen too many times. That kids will gravitate toward the parent who may be more lenient. And whenever you have a solid stand there with a mother and a father, that doesn't happen. And so parents need to work together. Husbands and wives need to work together. And then finally, the home is to be a place of interdependence. A place where husbands and wives cleave to each other and become one flesh. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Where we're mutually supportive of one another. I'm telling you, I'm blessed with a good home. Because to a very large extent, that good home was modeled before me by my parents. Grew up on a farm, and I couldn't wait to get off that farm. I used to think, boy, I'm telling you, if I ever get me an education, I'm leaving this dirt farm. I ain't never coming back. Well, I haven't been back, but in my heart, I wish I could go back. Because that was a great life. I was with my mother and daddy from daylight till dark and sometimes way after. And I've always said that I learned more about life at the end of a hoe handle than I ever learned in a classroom. Because my parents taught me about life. And I learned a lot from my grandmother. And if you're a grandparent, you can teach that next generation some important things as well. Thank you very much. God bless you all.